Well, good morning, everyone. I'm happy to be here. What I'm going to be presenting today was actually a very small part of my doctoral dissertation, and I have decided to explore it as my next research project, so it's just kind of in the works right now. Recent literature on leisure consumption and evolving consumer practices has begun to address the late 19th and early 20th century fad of play acting, where middle-class and well-to-do North Americans incorporated emblems of foreignness into their social activities, domestic interiors, and even daily mealtime. Whether it was dressing in a Japanese kimono, creating an Oriental cozy corner, or eating chili con carne, people primarily of white Anglo-Celtic and Western European descent were striving to appear worldly and cosmopolitan in an increasingly globalized society. The kitchen was one of the many stages where people acted out their cosmopolitanism, reinventing and making familiar exotic food. Women in particular used advice columns in ladies' magazines, newspapers, etiquette manuals, travel writings, and even cookbooks as their scripts, and food as a prop to fictitiously travel, gain geographic knowledge, and consume markers of a foreign culture from the comforts of home. This paper will explore the turn-of-the-century culture of culinary cosmopolitanism, a term coined by American historian Kristen L. Hoganson, which identifies ways that food in white Western societies was being internationalized. Most historical studies approach the trend from the vantage point of urbanites who were more exposed to foreign cultures via restaurants, social clubs, and immigrant enclaves. Analyses of the housewives and hostesses incorporating macaroni, curry, and chop suey into their dinner menus, however, rarely acknowledge that similar practices were occurring in rural areas and small towns, which will be my focus today. In some of the preliminary research uncovered, I have found that many rural and small town Ontarians were also willing to have exotic encounters on their dinner plates, though they never fully abandoned their traditional rural cultural norms and food preferences. Thus, the modes of culinary cosmopolitanism most often found in rural areas and small towns had been noticeably Canadianized to be more palatable and pay homage to their own heritage. Locals selectively chose what foods and mannerisms would represent the foreign peoples they were fictitiously encountering and embodying, conveniently leaving out those dishes or modes of preparation that did not suit Euro-Canadian tastes. So I'm going to look at some of the more notable ways that culinary cosmopolitanism was being exercised in rural and small town Ontario, mostly by second and third generation citizens who had never visited their Anglo-Celtic and Western European homelands, or even left Ontario for that matter. Attempts at cosmopolitanism were on full display at two community-wide fundraising fairs that took place in the small towns of Tillsmerg and Ingersoll in southwestern Ontario, the Garden Party of the Nations and the Feast of Nations. The food served at these events was an opportunity to explore foreign cultures, but citizens had limitations when it came to how much they would engage with the foreign. The food served at these fairs were, for the most part, the same dishes being consumed on a daily basis, but were given geographic appellations or uniquely presented in order to heighten their aesthetic appeal and make consumers feel well-traveled and sophisticated. Though culinary cosmopolitanism was lauded as a marker of modernity, most of the food served at these events instead appears to celebrate the strength and resiliency of rural life, particularly early settler societies and the ancestral homelands of rural citizens. An obvious nostalgia permeates the structures of these foreign feasts, indicating that food was an important way for second and third generation rural and small town Ontarians, who had no direct connections to the old country, to explore the customs and food ways of their ancestors. In this way, food acted as a form of power, with event organizers assimilating foreign food systems into the dominant Euro-Canadian one. When we look at the foods that late 19th and early 20th century rural and small town Ontarians consumed, we see that generally they were an amalgam of traditions imported from Britain and Ireland, Eastern Canada, New England, Germany, Scandinavia, and other Western European nations. Though the dishes appearing on dinner tables varied depending on the seasons, ethnic customs, class and wealth, and available resources, Information gleaned from cookbooks, women's diaries, and other sources tell us that the average diet was a mix of roasted, boiled, salted, and cold meats, soup, sandwiches, root vegetables, especially potatoes in the winter, seasonal produce in the summer, breads and biscuits, jellies, cheese and nuts, various condiments and sauces, and sweets like pudding, pie, cake, and fruit. Though canned and prepackaged goods were increasingly appearing on local grocers' shelves, most women continued to cook from scratch because it was a testament to culinary aptitude and frugality. Many were leery of prepackaged foods because of recent health scares, most notably reports of contracting mercury poisoning from canned goods. Diets, however, were somewhat in a transformative state as middle and upper class rural and small town Ontarians began to branch out and embrace new modes of leisure, dining, and entertaining. Growing populations, rising literacy rates, improved transportation networks, alterations to agricultural production, and evolving consumer practices meant that rural and small town Ontarians were more exposed to the social and cultural trends emerging in larger towns and cities than ever before. Various modes of print literature were increasingly publishing stories about food and dining practices, particularly those that were dubbed novel and avant-garde by the fashionable crowd. These treatises educated middle and upper class women in particular on how to use food as a way to distinguish themselves from less affluent friends, neighbors, and those in their immediate social circle. Like their city counterparts, rural and small town women were naturally drawn to the social cachet attached to this novelty. Concurrently, local grocers had begun importing more exotic goods like pineapple, lemons, and bananas. A greater variety of herbs and spices were also becoming available, including cinnamon, nutmeg, allspice, cloves, and cardamom seeds, which could add flair to any ho-hum dish. Kate Aiken, who grew up in the small town of Beaton in Simcoe County around the turn of the century, was the daughter of a general store owner, and she remembered these spices, quote, smelling like magic. Just by looking at them, she says, quote, we traveled the world. According to food historian Dorothy Duncan, Christmas was a popular time to import exotic fare like spices, lemons, oranges, English cheese, dried fruit, and nuts, which would be paired with the traditional holiday fare of roasted fowl, yams, and plum pudding. Home study clubs like dramatic societies and travelers' clubs, which were becoming more popular in rural districts, also became domains where hostesses could dress up and/or serve atypical and stylish cuisine. In a traveler's club, for instance, members imaginatively vacationed to an exotic locale, and dressing up in ethnic garb and consuming ethnic cuisine were part of the fun. Here, the Tilsonburg Ladies Travel Club is partaking in tea, but dressing in kimonos makes the practice appear that much more refined and help them feel like local citizens. Well-known North American women's magazines like Harper's Bazaar, The Delineator, and the Canadian Home Journal educated female readers on how to host around-the-world-themed parties and events. Many articles were in response to readers' requests for such material, and the readership was a mix of rural and city dwellers. A Venetian-themed soiree, for example, ought to consist of Neapolitan ice cream or a simple ice served with fresh fruit syrup, dainty cakes, and lemonade. Some cold chicken and a green salad could also lend authenticity to any Italian feast. At a German or Dutch luncheon, cold chicken, lettuce salad with stewed cherries, Dutch cream cheese and crackers, apple cake, and coffee were recommended. Many women simply added geographic appellations to make dishes sound more appealing and exotic. When E.D. and Marianne Tilson of Tilsonburg hosted a crazy tea for 75 guests in February of 1892, the event was an opportunity for the host to exhibit their knowledge of history, the fine arts, and global politics, all important markers of highbrow culture. Each course served was disguised in a riddle and linked to a geographic locale or drew on the popular culture and political atmosphere of the day. Mocha, for example, was dubbed Arabian wine, and roast turkey was disguised as, quote, a distressed country. For hostesses and housewives who desired to expand their culinary repertoire, recipes for simple dishes that had been internationalized, such as Irish potatoes, Mexican rice, Turkish pilaf, and Scotch wafers, were becoming ever more popular and common. Even the serving of food was being internationalized. the adoption of French nomenclature, such as entree instead of main course, had become popular around this time, as well as serving salad at the end of the meal, as one article in the Rural Canadian suggested. Located in Oxford County, approximately 25 kilometers apart, the small towns of Tillsmerg and Ingersoll were largely composed of Canadian-born citizens who were of Anglo-Celtic and Western European descent. Their social and cultural worlds were similar to those of almost any small town in southern Ontario at the time, consisting of a mix of church bazaars, social club meetings, local sports matches, home parties, harvest dinners, and fundraising feasts. The more affluent had begun to embark on transcontinental and transoceanic jaunts. In 1893, when the World's Columbian Exposition was debuting in Chicago, Illinois, a number of Tillsmerg and Ingersoll citizens left town by train to visit the spectacle, because it was the closest that international exhibition of its caliber had come to Canada. Upon their arrival back home, fairgoers spoke highly of the sights and sounds they had encountered, especially the famed Midway Plaisance, with its collection of reconstructed ethnological villages. 8 months after the gates of the exposition shut for good, Tillsmerg held its very own version of the Midway Plaisance on a warm Tuesday evening in July 1894. Organized under the auspices of the local Epworth League, the event, called the Garden Party of the Nations, was held on the vast lawn surrounding Edie and Marion Tilson's grandiose home. The event was constructed to be a sale-of-work bazaar, a popular mode of raising money for various municipal, religious, and charitable causes. So there were pictures taken at the Garden Party of the Nations, which unfortunately I haven't been able to find. They may not exist anymore. But I found this picture, and this is a Garden Party of the Nations that was held on Governor's Island, New York in 1908. And it just provides a visual of what the Garden Party of the Nations looked like, because there were quite a few similarities between the two. When the Garden Party premiered, the local Tillsmerg Observer reported that a number of booths were set up on the Tilson's manicured lawn, each colorfully decorated with flags, bunting, and national symbols, indicative of the country or ethnic group present. The booths employed popular 19th century motifs to symbolize countries such as Canada, the southern region of the United States, Iceland, China, and Japan, which were homogenized in one booth, Ireland, Scotland, and England. And these are just some of the inspirations from the Midway Plaisance that were used in Tillsmerg. So the German village at the top and then Donegal Castle at the Irish village. At each booth, local men and women acted as costumed interpreters, doling out ethnic food, singing ethnic songs, and offering authentic handicrafts for a small fee. Dubbed, quote, the greatest novelty of the season by the Tillsmerg Observer, the town's first ever Garden Party of the Nations attracted 800 spectators with receipts totaling $100. The Garden Party's debut was such a hit that successive events were held for a number of years after. 2 years later, in June 1896, Ingersoll held its version of the Midway Plaisance, dubbed the Feast of Nations, which lasted for 3 days. Also organized as a charitable venture, the event was held inside a local arena where, similar to Tillsmerg, a number of colorfully adorned booths were erected and manned by costumed locals, doling out so-called authentic dinners for a fee. According to the Ingersoll Chronicle, the event was visited by hundreds and considered, quote, an undeniable success, the proceeds netting over $500. The booths were described as gems of architectural art and even included massive recreations of Windsor and Edinburgh castles. The Ingersoll Chronicle declared that of the various nationalities present, which included England, Scotland, Canada, France, New England, China and Japan, Spain and Italy, and Germany, their representations in the way of food and costume, quote, were really excellent and true to nature. The original Midway Plaisance at the Columbian Exposition was populated by a vast array of races, religions, and cultures, including nations from sub-Sahara Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. But the Garden Party of the Nations and the Feast of Nations, with the exception of China and Japan, were devoid of Eastern representations. In spite of the predominance of whiteness, the Ingersoll Chronicle declared just prior to the opening of the feast that, quote, nearly all the nations of the world would be represented, each nationality occupying a booth and catering to the public after the manner peculiar to the people represented. Normally at foreign-themed dinners and leisure activities, preferences regarding the nations and cultures on display were based on the extent of their foreignness, organizers and hosts believed that the more foreign the spectacle, the more likely a profit would be turned. However, in Tilsmering and Ingersoll, organizers decided not only to include but also to highlight the Canadian, British, and Irish booths, reflecting their dominant heritage along with the boundaries on their expression of culinary cosmopolitanism. The bill of fare at each event, for instance, consisted of fairly standard cuisine, most of which visitors were serving at their own tables. But in that contrived atmosphere, amongst the flags, bunting, and costumes, the dishes were anything but ordinary. At the Feast of Nations, for example, China and Japan's culinary contribution was tea, which was a staple in rural and small-town households. The German delicacies being served included bologna, sausage, Limburger cheese, sauerkraut, pretzels, and all kinds of soft drinks. Again, not all that out of the ordinary, especially in households of German descent. At the Canadian booth, ice cream and, quote, other delicious refreshments were, quote, in constant demand. Not because they were uniquely Canadian, but because it was June and ice cream was satisfying inside a hot, stuffy arena. At the Garden Party of the Nations in Tilsmering in 1895, bananas, oranges, and ice cream were served at the Italian booth. A traditional English dinner of roast beef and plum pudding was provided by costumed Brits. Ice cream was offered at a number of booths, including Greenland, and representatives from the southern United States, cloaked in minstrel show stereotypes, served watermelon to the hundreds of spectators. Clearly, authenticity was not foremost in the minds of organizers, in spite of local newspaper reporters' claims. Instead, seasonal and popular delicacies like ice cream were favored, coupled with idealized misconceptions of pre-modern and foreign peoples. Though the cookery at both events was dominated by dishes popular among white Western societies, organizers still made careful choices about what foods would be served. Less appetizing but more bona fide European delicacies such as snails, horse meat sausages, and pâté de foie gras were noticeably absent. Again inspired by the Midway Plaisance, at both the Garden Party of the Nations and the Feast of Nations, a booth was devoted to colonial New England, where Yankee delicacies like Boston baked beans, pumpkin pie, and cider were doled out by, quote, prim Puritans. The booth at the Feast of Nations even included a small historical pageant consisting of women dressed as suffrage crusader Lucretia Mott, Martha Washington, and the Goddess of Liberty. At the various garden parties of the nations in Tilsonburg, the New Englanders were described as, quote, quaint and sober pilgrims, wearing Quaker dress and bonnets. Harkening back to an era of pre-industrial simplicity and the ways that continental Europe was imagined by event organizers, was likely meant to be a positive representation and a valorization of rural life. Because a number of the party's organizers grew up in the era before rail travel and modern conveniences complicated the pace of daily life, using unsophisticated and pastoral symbolism can be better understood as a way to celebrate and remember the hardships of their ancestors, and perhaps stave off some of the less desirable changes resulting from industrialization and urbanization. Though ingesting so-called foreign foods was a form of escapism and lent adventure to daily life, by no means was this an everyday practice in rural and small-town Ontario. For the most part, culinary cosmopolitanism was restricted to dinner parties, leisure activities, and fundraisers like the Garden Party of the Nations and the Feast of Nations. However, from the preliminary research I have uncovered thus far, the foodways of late 19th and early 20th century rural and small-town Ontario appear to have been in the midst of a transformation, as they blended modern and traditional approaches, giving way to new rural food and social cultures. Along with embracing recent culinary trends, such as costume dinners and foreign-themed feasts, citizens used food to celebrate their pastoral pasts by serving what they perceived to be traditional fare from the old country. Sprinkled amongst the sauerkraut, haggis, and ice cream, however, was the occasional glimpse of their fascination with foreign places like the Far East. But compared to citizens of larger towns and cities who typically ignored Euro-North American cultures when they played dress-up, in rural and small-town Ontario, even when play-acting, there appears to have been a nostalgic yearning to celebrate their own culinary roots, traditions, and gastronomic preferences. In this sense, they were redefining culinary cosmopolitanism as they focused less on unfamiliar locales and more on establishing ties with their ancestral homelands. Thank you.